Going to do a topic switch, not because I don't think it would be good for us to do the lesson that would be here for us as well, but somebody in particular had asked a question, and if we do it now, then they don't get to have it then. So we'll save that lesson for another time. And what I want to do tonight is do a look at the book of Revelation from the standpoint of equipping us to be able to help other people get a grasp on it. Lots of times when you're talking to somebody, so it's not going to be a detailed study of the book of Revelation by any means, and there's a lot of things, of most everything, we won't cover. But you, like me, run into people that have some interest in the Bible, and what's one of the things that they always want to talk about? The book of Revelation. Sometimes that's the thing that they're most interested in. And if they've been watching television preachers or getting prophecy books from their local religious bookstore, they're probably indoctrinated with the ideas that the book of Revelation is about whatever political geo stuff is going on right now. You know, if it was back during the first Gulf War, people were talking about how does Saddam Hussein tie into the book of Revelation? Back in the early 1900s, they were talking about Turkey, the nation of Turkey, and how it played in. Mussolini, I've got a book that says, you know, that suggests that Mussolini is the Antichrist. Whatever's going on, futurists, the people that think it's about right now, tend to do that. And so we're going to go over some things about the book of Revelation. I'm going to ask the men to participate, and I'll be asking some questions. And here are some chapter numbers I want you to remember. I want you to remember chapter 1, especially verses 1 through 9. And we'll also talk a little bit about chapters 2 through 3, a little bit about chapters 4 through 5. We're going to talk about 12 and 13, and then we'll look at like 20 and 22. And we'll just hit some key points out of there that if you'll show them to someone, it can help them get an idea of what's going on. So let's begin with chapter 1. And would one of you brothers please read the first three verses? And remember, we're going over this. It's information for us, but I really want you to be thinking about how you can communicate this to other people by remembering these key passages. Okay, can I have a brother read verse 1 through 3, please? All right, so this is a revelation, and it's John writes it, and if you drop down to verse 9, you'll see where he's at. I, John, your brother and partaker with you in the tribulation and kingdom patience, was in the isle that is called Patmos. Patmos is an island right around here. It's a little rocky island. History, later ecclesiastical history, tells us that he had been exiled there by the Caesar. And so he's stuck out there on that island. And he's going to write this. It's a revelation of what? By the way, it's not revelations. It's revelation. The revelation of Jesus Christ. And notice, when you're talking with somebody, have them focus on verse 1. It says what? This revelation that he's going to send, he's written it down, and he's going to send it around to these churches. It's probably written, often it's dated to be about 95 AD. Some people would date it earlier. I'm inclined to go along with this date here, but whatever the case, latter first century. And it's what? Verse 1 tells us it's about what? Things that must happen when? Yeah, things that must happen soon. So right off the bat, Is that the way you would think a writing would start that's written about what would happen thousands of years later? Right? Then the next thing you want to do is help them see who it's written to. Verse 4. John, to the seven churches in Asia. This is Asia Minor right here. And so he's writing to these churches. There's seven of them. And they're kind of in a shape like this. Laodicea will be the last one over there. And he says in verse 9, I, John, your brother and partaker with you, what are the two things, or three things, that he says he's in with them? Something that they're in and something that he's in verse 9.
Tribulation.
Yeah, he's in the tribulation with them. What else? The kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ. Now this is really important because the people who take the book of Revelation to be about the future think the tribulation hasn't come yet, the tribulation that they talk about, and they think the kingdom hasn't come yet. So this verse right here is really key to helping understand the whole picture. They were already in the tribulation. The tribulation John's talking about is one he was in, and brethren he was writing to was in. And the kingdom is not something off in the future. The kingdom is something they are already in. All right? Then you have the letters to the seven churches. There's a letter to the church at Ephesus. There's a letter to the church at Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Some futurists take these letters to be spanning over church history. So the church at Ephesus was the early church, and then the church at Smyrna later, and that kind of is your bridge that shoots you off into the beginning. Well, no. What did they do with the letter after John wrote it? They took it to these seven cities and read it in these seven churches. These letters are not about us. These letters are about them. What are some of the things happening to them? Chapter 2, verse 9. I know your tribulation. Verse 10. Fear not the things you're about to suffer. You're about to be cast into prison. To the church in Pergamum. Verse 13. I know where you dwell, even where Satan's throne is. You held fast my name and didn't deny my faith, even the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. So you've got a lot of churches that talk about that this book is about what's about to happen right now. And the people in these churches are not being thrown in prison, and they're not being killed. What was happening to the brethren that this was written to? That was happening to some of them. So they were in the tribulation then. All right, then we get to chapter 3. After he finishes up the, chapter 4. After you finish up the letters, chapter 4 has a scene of what? Just look over chapter 4, and one of your brethren just kind of sum up what you see in chapter 4. Yeah, it's the throne scene in heaven. All right? And so it is a glorious scene, and the Father is sitting on the throne, and the people in heaven, or the creatures, the spiritual beings in heaven, are what? Worshiping he that is on the throne. So down here, these people are facing trials. There's also trouble spiritually. Some of them are listening to a false prophetess. Some of them are left their first love. Some of them are about to be facing persecution, etc. But this is the scene in heaven. Now, chapter 5. In the right hand of him that sat on the throne is a book sealed with seven seals. Ancient people would seal a document. You'd like put a string around it, put some hot wax, and seal it. This is sealed with seven seals, and nobody can open it. Verse 2, I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a great voice, who is worthy to open the book and loose the seals? No one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open it. I wept much because no one was found worthy to open the book. And then, what did one of the elders say in verse 5? Weep not because? Yeah, the lion of the tribe of Judah is overcome and he can open it. So you turn around to look at the lion, and what does he see? A lamb standing as though it had been slain. And what do they say? He comes, he takes the book, verse 7, out of the hand of him that's on the throne, and he opens it up. And they sing a new song, verse 9. Worthy art thou to take the book, to open the seals, for you were slain and did purchase unto God with your blood men of every tribe, tongue, people, and nation. And you made them to be unto our God a kingdom and priests. And in verse 12, worthy is the Lamb that has been slain to receive the power, the riches, the wisdom, the might, the honor, and the glory, and the blessing. And then in the end of verse 13, unto him that sits on the throne and unto the Lamb be blessing, honor, and glory, dominion forever and ever. And they worship him. One thing you can point out right here is the symbolic nature of the book. You get in trouble if you take this book literally. Who did he say can open a book? The lion. He looks around and he sees a what? A lamb. Is that literal, or are they symbols representing Jesus? They're symbols representing Jesus, obviously. And that's a real simple way to show how symbolism can work in the Bible. By the way, if you look back at chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, even the things that must shortly come to pass, he sent and signified it. Now, I'm not sure, but some commentators believe that the significance of the word signified there is referring to the fact that it's given in signs. So you have signs and symbols, that type of thing. All right, so now Jesus can start opening up the seals. Well, in chapter 6, he opens up a seal, and there's horses of different colors that come, and then there's judgments and scary things, and we're not going to go through all of those. But drop down to chapter 12. And somebody please read verse 1 through 4. All right, so there is a pregnant woman, and there is a great red dragon. And the great red dragon sees the pregnant woman and is waiting for her to give birth and to devour her child. That is a very hopeless picture. You know, a pregnant woman about to give birth is about as vulnerable a person as you're going to find. And a great red dragon whose tail knocks a third of the stars out of heaven. And yet, what happens? Verse 5, she's delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. That goes back to Psalm 2, Messianic Psalm. And her child was caught up to God and unto his throne. So he's going to try to devour this child, but he failed. And instead, the child is caught up to the right hand of God. Well, of course, where was Jesus seated when he ascended? At the right hand. Psalm 110. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. That's what Peter quotes on the day of Pentecost. Now, verse 7. There's war where? In heaven. Who's doing battle? Michael and his angels go forth against the dragon. By the way, this is kind of interesting. It's not the Father had to go fight the dragon. It's not Jesus goes and fights the dragon. Michael and his angels take care of the dragon. And what's the result? They prevailed not, that is, Satan and his angels, They prevailed not, neither was their place found any more. The great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, he is cast down, and his angels are cast down with him. That where it said that his tail knocked out a third of the stars of heaven, that's probably a symbolic reference to angels that followed Satan. Now, where was he? It described him being in heaven. But now he's failed, and he is cast down. So what looked disastrous, what looked like a tragedy, what looked hopeless, this child is now at the right hand of the throne, and the dragon is cast down, and so he's down here now, that old serpent. And of course, that, why does it say the old serpent? It's calling our mind back to Genesis chapter 3. And what's the result? Here's the result. Verse 10. I heard a great voice in heaven saying, this is important. Now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God. When did the kingdom come? Jesus was born. Jesus ascended to the right hand of God. Defeated was the devil, and the kingdom came. So the kingdom is not off in the future. The final stage of the kingdom, when we inherit everlasting life in the resurrected body, in the sense of some verses in the Bible speak to the kingdom phase in that future sense like this. 1 Corinthians 15, flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall inherit the kingdom, but on that day. There's the kingdom victorious post-judgment day that is still future. But the kingdom militant has been here since that point there. And so the kingdom has come. This is vital for helping premillennialists. All right, so the kingdom has come, and the accuser of the kingdom has come, the authority of Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuses them before our God day and night. Watch the positioning of Satan. In the beginning, we see he's looking at what's going on up here, and now he's cast down to the earth. That doesn't mean that's the first time sin was going on. You're going to see Satan in several places in this book. You're going to see this scene in heaven. Then you're going to see a scene on earth. Then you're going to see him locked in an abyss. Then you're going to see him thrown into the lake of fire. And if we make the mistake of thinking, oh, the only time that he was active and there was any sin on earth is when he's right on earth, well, that's just nonsense. Because when does he get thrown down to the earth? Only after the ascension of Christ. Was there no temptation before that? Of course there was. Again, don't think of this too literally, but think also back to the book of Job. Where is Satan when he's trying to get Job in trouble? Coming before God. And what's he trying to do? Does he want to justify Job? No, it calls him here the what? The accuser of the brethren. And without the blood of Jesus Christ, where would you and I stand in front of Satan's accusations? Yeah. Could we say, no, that's not true. He's lying about me. No, he would be telling the truth about me. What would be my defense before the accusations of Satan without Jesus Christ? You see, when Jesus died, he did two magnificent things. On Friday, he died and paid for your sins and my sins, made the way out of spiritual death. And on Sunday, he rose from the dead, showing the way and providing the way out of physical death. Spiritual death conquered on Friday, physical death conquered on Sunday. Pardon me. So, you've got, in what Jesus accomplished, you remember when Joe was talking this morning? Judgment for the wicked is deliverance for the righteous. Jesus conquers and wins, Satan is defeated and thrown down. But if he's defeated and thrown down, what kind of mood do you suppose he's in? There's rejoicing in heaven, verse 10. In heaven, it's, now is the salvation, the power, and the kingdom of our God, and the authority of Christ. For his accuser of our brother is cast down, who accuseth them before God day and night. They overcame because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of the testimony. They loved not their life even unto death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens. But what do we have in the middle of verse 12? Woe to what? Woe to the earth and sea. Because the devil's gone down and he's got what? Great wrath. Drop down to chapter 13, verse 1. Verse 12, 17. The dragon waxed angry with the woman, went away to make war with the rest of her seed. Who would that be? And that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So if you're the devil and you didn't get to destroy the Christ, who do you want to destroy? His followers. So now he's going to attack them. And so he's going to have two allies or puppets. He's going to have the sea beast, and he's going to have the earth beast. He's standing, I think better manuscript evidence is, he's standing on the sand of the sea. And so here's the water on one side and here's the land on the other. And up from the water, like in the book of Daniel, the nations in the vision, the beast representing the nations came up where? Out of the water. Up out of the water comes the sea beast. And it's what? I saw a beast coming up, and what's going to go on with this beast? Look at verse 7. I'm sorry, I thought I turned that off. I'll get it off for sure this time. There we go. It's off. Sorry about that. The beast comes up out of the sea, and it's going to do what in verse 7? It's going to make war with the saints and overcome them. And there was given unto him authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. And you see people worshiping the beast and saying back in verse 4, at the end of verse 4, who is like the beast and who is able to war with him? So if Satan, when Jesus ascended to heaven, I'm sorry, I'm having all kinds of trouble up here. When Jesus ascended to heaven, Satan gets cast down, and he's angry, and he grabs a empire, a power, a nation to attack the church with that rules over the kingdoms of men. At the time that Jesus ascended into heaven, what nation would that be? It's the Roman Empire. And so it starts attacking Christians. And do we know from history that that happened? Yes, it did. All right. Then there's another beast in verse 11. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke like a dragon. He exercises all the authority of the first beast and makes people worship this beast. So this is not a separate empire. This is not another kingdom. It's something that operates within the authority of this one. Back in Daniel, it's nations, kingdoms that come up out of the sea. This doesn't come up out of the sea. This is an adjunct of this. It forces people to worship the beast. And if you go through and look at the rest of the verses, it gets people to worship the beast. There were people in the Roman Empire whose job was, and persecution went from, you had Nero's persecution in Rome, and then you had Domitian's persecution, and then you had about 13 waves of persecution. Not every Caesar, not every emperor was persecuting Christians. Likewise, some were worse than others, and it's going to be stopped by Constantine. But in between, there's about 13 waves of persecution, and at times there would be officials, and what they would do, they would make sure that you worshiped Caesar. If you went in and you burnt incense and worshiped Caesar, they would give you a certificate saying that you were good to go. We so-and-so representatives of the emperor have seen you sacrifice. Well, that would be the mark of the beast. You know, and then you're protected, but what have you just done? You've betrayed your Lord. So you have conflict going on in describing this. You've got this scene in chapter 13, and then if you look in chapter 14, you see something else. Satan's down there on the sand. His beast is coming up out of here, and there's an earth beast coming up out of here. But look here on Mount Zion. And who's going to be up on Mount Zion? The Lamb and the 144,000. And then you have conflict is going to be building here, and there's judgments and different things. Jump over to chapter 17. This helps nail down that we're talking about Rome. I forgot to put 17 up there. Chapter 17 is really important because you have this. He sees a beast, and the beast is carrying a harlot. And what is the harlot drinking in verse 4? Right. So here's a beast. Here's a harlot riding on the beast. And in her hand is a cup, and it's got the blood of the saints in it. And in fact, she's getting drunk on the blood of the saints. And the beast that she is riding has seven heads. And the seven heads are seven kings, but they're not only seven kings, they're seven mountains. Look at verse 9. Here's the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. The woman is sitting on seven mountains. Now look at the last verse of the chapter. Verse 18. The woman whom you saw is what? The great city that rules over the kings of the earth. What city at this time ruled over the kings of the earth? Rome. What was known as the city of seven hills? Rome. Now, people have tried to come up with different places. Some have tried to say Jerusalem is what this one is. No, this one's not Jerusalem, because Jerusalem did not rule over the kings of the earth at this time, among other things. There is some stuff related to other things in the book, but this is clearly Rome here. If you just look up, you know, Google, you know, City of Seven Hills. That's what Rome is famously known as. Now, there's going to be this battle, and in the battle, by the time you get to chapter 19, you see the victor, and it's Jesus. He's King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and look at verse 19, chapter 19, verse 19. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to make war against him that sat upon the horse and against his army. The beast was taken, and with him the false prophet. As you go through the book, the earth beast seems to later be called the false prophet, the religious arm of the Roman government getting people to worship the beast. Now watch what happens here carefully as we begin to bring the lesson toward a close. What happens to the beast and the false prophet in verse 20? The beast was taken, and with him the false prophet, and they are cast where? Into the lake of fire. Cast into the lake of fire. Cast into the lake of fire. Watch what happens to the dragon. He's not cast into the lake of fire. It's not the end for him yet. Instead, he's restrained. Chapter 20. I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. Why the difference? Why not throw him into the lake of fire? That is what will happen to him later in the chapter. But that's not yet. His beast, thrown into the lake of fire. His false prophet, thrown into the lake of fire. Him, chained, bound, sealed in the abyss. That he might not deceive the nations any longer, not any longer, until the 1,000 years be finished. So he's restrained. Now, when some people read this text, they would get the idea that during this time, there can't be any evil. There can't be any sin, can't be any temptation. Back up. Where was Satan earlier in the book? Was there sin and stuff in the earth? Yes, there was. Then he's here, now he's here, and there's sin and temptation all along. But he's restrained, and this is where the 1,000 years comes in. People think that the 1,000 years is when Jesus comes back and he begins his reign, and he reigns on earth for 1,000 years. This is the only text in the Bible that talks about the 1,000 years. The only one. And here's what's not in it. Jesus coming back to earth, Jesus reigning on the earth, or Jesus beginning his reign here. This isn't when Jesus began his reign. When did Jesus begin his reign? We saw it a few minutes ago. Back in chapter 12. What did it say? He ascended to the right hand of God. Remember Psalm 110? Sit at my right hand and rule. He ascended to the right hand of God, and what did the angels say? Now has come the kingdom. Not, hey, you know, later at the end of the book will come the kingdom. No. Now has come the kingdom. He started reigning then. This is not about when Jesus began his reign. This is about when the martyred saints begin to reign with him. That's a different thing. So let's read that real quick. I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the abyss and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on the dragon, the old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, bound him for 1,000 years, so that he would not, what? Deceive the nations anymore until 1,000 years be finished. Verse 4, I saw the thrones and they that sat upon them. Judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those that had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus, for the word of God, and such as did not worship the beast nor his image and received not the mark upon their forehead. And they lived and what? Reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Does everybody see that? The way everybody takes this, they think this is when Jesus begins to reign and he will reign for 1,000 years. No, he'd been reigning. This is after the beast is destroyed. The martyred saints reign with Jesus, who's already been reigning. In fact, he was reigning way back in chapter 1. Because what did John say? John, to the 7 churches, I'm a brother with you and a partaker in the kingdom. Then, at the end of 1,000 years, Satan tries again something similar. And he will again fail. Now, could some of the things that we see going badly in the world today lead to that? Perhaps so. But finally, we have the day of judgment. And at the end, what happens in verse 10? Now the devil that deceived them is going to be what? Cast in the lake of fire and brimstone. Now he's done. And we have judgment, verse 11. I saw a great white throne, him that sat on it. And then you see in verse 12 what? I saw the dead, the great, the small, standing before the throne. Books are open, and they're judged out of the books. The dead are there. The sea gives up the dead that are in them, and this is judgment day. This is the end. And what about the earth? Well, it's no more. The sea gave up. Verse 15, if any was not found written in the book of life, he was cast in the lake of fire. Chapter 21, verse 1, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For what? The first heaven and the first earth are what? Passed away. And lastly, look at chapter 22. There's a picture here of eternal life. And as Bob Waldron describes the Bible, from garden to garden. It started off what? With paradise and the tree of life. And it ends where? Paradise and the tree of life. He showed me a river, a water of life, bright, shining as crystal. There's the tree giving the fruit and everything, and it's eternal life. And John starts to worship before the angel, and the angel says, no, worship God. And then it says this, verse 10. He said to me, seal not up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. Here's why that's interesting. If you go back to the book of Daniel, What did it say at the end of Daniel? Daniel chapter 12. Seal, right. Seal up the words of this book, for the time is, it's later. It's for the future time. You see the stripe contrast at the end of Revelation? Don't seal up the words of this book, because the time is at hand. So if you remember those chapters, if you're talking with a friend and they're really confused about the book of Revelation, there's a lot of things I don't understand about the book of Revelation and don't know about the book of Revelation. But here's some things that are pretty obvious. Right there in chapter 1, the very first verse said it was about things that would happen when? Soon. And in verse 9, we see they were already in the kingdom and already in the tribulation. And we see who it was written to. It wasn't written directly to us. We can benefit from it, but who was it written to? People that were already in tribulation, and one of them had already been killed. And you see that God's in charge, and we see the sun, and we see this battle of this great dragon, Satan, trying to destroy the Christ, but instead Christ is victorious. He's defeated. The kingdom came, and he's cast down, and he's mad. And it doesn't say he was mad and he thought, I'm going to just sit here for a couple thousand years, but in the 21st century, I'm going to remember it and do something. That's not what it said. He goes down and he makes war against those that followed Christ. And he used what? An empire that was there that did wage war on Christians. A city that was built on seven. I don't know how many things we're going to drop. A city that was built on seven hills, a city that did shed the blood of Christians, but who won the battle? Christ wins the battle. Thank you for your attention, and I'm sorry, I don't know when I've had as many distractions and everything going on. Thank you for bearing with me. If you need to respond, won't you do so in preparation for that day to stand before God as we stand and sing?